Dan Brown, as we know, is the author of numerous number one best-selling novels, including The Da Vinci Code, one of the best-selling novels of all time. In 2005, Time magazine named Brown one of the 100 most influential people in the world. Many credit him with keeping the publishing industry afloat and spiking tourism to whatever city he writes about. The son of a mathematics teacher and a church organist, Brown was raised on a prep school campus where he developed a fascination with the interplay between science and religion. He's a graduate of Amherst College and Phillips Exeter Academy, where he later returned to teach English before turning his attention to writing. Today, we'll speak with him about his newest blockbuster, Inferno. Welcome, Dan. It's a thrill to have you with us on the Book Report.
Well, the pleasure's mine. Thanks for having me.
Inferno features the population apocalypse equation. One can only assume the subject scares the hell out of you. Tell us about it.
Well, you're right. The subject does scare the hell out of me. We, in the last 70 to 80 years, have tripled the human population on Earth. That's one lifetime. We've tripled the population. We are headed, at least in my view, for a whole lot of trouble. And, you know, one of the things about writing books that are so labor-intensive is that I've got to choose a topic that fascinates me, and in this case, frightens me, and so I stay interested in it.
Right. How real is genetic germline manipulation?
It's absolutely real. It's funny, for the research of this book, I ended up talking to a bunch of geneticists, and I kept saying, well, can we do this? Can we do that? And finally, one of these guys said, look, the genetic toolbox is so powerful now that we can do absolutely anything. The only barriers to entry are really ethics and money. So we have some pretty important ethical questions to ask ourselves in the coming years when it comes to genetic engineering.
Oh, boy. Now, do you ever worry that your readers take all of your writing as gospel truth and they don't or can't separate fact from fiction?
I don't, because the books are novels. I think readers are smart people, and they understand that the characters are fictional and the action's fictional. And at the same time, I feel like it's important that these characters move through a landscape that is real. For example, all the locations are real. The science is real. The ethical issues are real. I don't actually, this surprises people, but I don't read a lot of fiction. I read nonstop, but it's almost exclusively nonfiction because I just like to, learn. And that's, I think, why my fans enjoy these books, is that they're fun, fast-paced thrillers, but you also learn a little bit about the real world along the way.
Right. How do you research the science in your book? It's so intriguing.
You know, it's funny. I have found through the years that there is no substitute for talking to specialists. I mean, you can read books, you can look online, whatever it is, but all of my best information comes from people who are leaders in their field. And it turns out people are always eager to talk about the things that they know about. And so it's never any trouble to find a great geneticist who's dying to sit down and tell you about his business.
Well, you know, that's one thing that's so amazing about your books is that you make the science accessible to those like myself who are not scientists.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that. That's one of the hardest things I do because, you know, in the case of this book, I didn't know a lot about genetic engineering before I started researching the book, and I had to learn it to a point where I could distill it such that I could understand it, and in hopes, you know, other people, lay people like myself, could also understand it.
Right. Okay, the city of Florence features so prominently in Inferno. How much time did you spend there, and how did you research both the political and the art history?
Well, I spent quite a bit of time there on three separate trips and was fortunate to you know, make contact with some terrific curators and terrific historians who, you know, let me into some places that, you know, realistically I wouldn't have gotten into had I not been writing the follow-up to the Da Vinci Code in some ways, in their mind at least, another book set in Europe. You know, it really is a question of finding the right people who will tell you the more interesting information, the stuff that you don't see in the history books and the stuff that you don't see just on the regular public tours.
Well, I recently visited Istanbul, and I spent some time in the Sunken Palace after reading Inferno, and Inferno really captures the place. How much time did you spend underground?
That's a funny question. I guess from the descriptions, it sounds like I spent a lot of time there I don't think I spent more than an hour there because I, like Langdon, am a little bit claustrophobic.
And
I was down there, took a whole lot of notes. I even took recordings of the space. The acoustics in the space were interesting to me, and so I have recordings of the acoustics in the space, lots and lots of photos and videos, and then I couldn't wait to get back above ground. And I think some of my discomfort with being down there helped fuel the writing of those scenes that I hope feel a little bit oppressive.
Yeah. I have a girl question to ask you now. Not a question, but a comment. Your thrillers usually team Robert Langdon up with incredibly smart, resourceful women, and I want to thank you for that. Tell us a little about this book's Sienna Brooks.
Well, in general, I write smart, interesting women because I find them much more interesting. I married one. And Sienna Brooks is a, she has a very, an exceptionally high IQ. She's sort of an outlier in that sense, that she has a very, very powerful mind and at a very, very young age learned this and was ostracized because of it. And so in some ways it's her greatest asset, but it's also her Achilles heel that she has some sort of social issues because of her sort of hyper-intelligence. And of course, it's a great foil for Langdon. She knows a lot about medicine and genetic engineering, and of course, he knows very little. And so, in their conversations, Langdon is teaching her about art and history and Dante, and she's teaching him about genetics. And in the process, the reader's learning about both.
Hmm. Well, without giving away any details of the book's ending, this ending is very different from other books of yours. What has reader response been like?
You know, I was very, I wouldn't say I was nervous, but I was very curious what would happen when this book came out. And I'm relieved to say reader response has been terrific. What you're hinting at here is that the book is not as tied up and as neatly a package as my previous books. There definitely is resolution, and it's definitely a satisfying ending. And yet there's a little bit of an ellipsis at the end, a dot, 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 wondering what happens next. And a lot of readers have written and said, well, I can't wait for the sequel. So we'll see if that happens or not.
Well, speaking of sequel, do tourist boards of every major city in the world beg you to set a story in their city?
You know, it's funny you say that. Clearly, places like Paris and Rome and Florence are world-class cities and don't need me to spark their tourism. At the same time, these books and in some cases the movies generate a huge influx of tourism. And yes, I do get a whole lot of beautiful books from the heads of different tourism bureaus saying, look at Andorra, isn't it beautiful? Or look at the Czech Republic, or look at, come visit us. Look at a lot of places in South America would love for me to come. So I have to find a location that has a story built into it.
Well, have you chosen a location for your next book?
I can't possibly tell you.
Oh!
It's all very secret.
All right. I often wonder, can you write Robert Langdon now and not envision Tom Hanks? Does he embody your earliest vision of Langdon?
You know, it's funny. The answer is no. I don't. I love Tom Hanks. He's terrific. We're very, very fortunate to have him playing Langdon. But I spend so much time with the Langdon that I created in my mind. And I spent a lot of time, many, many years with that Langdon before a movie was made. So the quantity of time that I spend with my own personal Langdon is so much more than I spend, seeing the movies, that I really don't cross that line. I'm sure for readers, many of them do cross that line, and that's fine. But for me, no, I've got a very specific Langdon in mind.
Is there an inner Langdon in you?
Well, Langdon's a whole lot smarter than I am. He lives a much more exciting life. But certainly there's some crossover in that there's a lot of intellectual curiosity. There's some questions about religion and history and a love of adventure. But I guess that's probably where the similarities lie. It's funny, somebody asked me a similar question. I said, well, Langdon's a lot smarter than I am. And this woman kind of said, well, how can that be? Because everything that Langdon says, you had to think of. And I had to explain to her that, when Langdon walks by a painting and gives an off-the-cuff, brilliant, synopsis of what the painting is symbolizing, that took me 3 days to write. So, there you have it.
All right. And is there a movie in the works for Inferno, and are you involved?
Yes, there is a movie in the works. Everyone at Sony and Imagine and Tom Hanks and everybody is very, very excited about Inferno. It's a very visual. For those who've read the book, they'll know that it's an exceptionally visual, high stakes drama. It will translate well to the screen, and they are working very, very hard on the script, which I'll see soon. And I am involved in the movies. Clearly, I know the books. Arguably better than anybody else. At the same time, I'm not a filmmaker, and I would never presume to tell the likes of Ron Howard how to make a movie. So I chime in here and there, but for the most part, I leave it to the professionals.
So do universities now feature courses on symbology because of you?
I've actually heard that some do. Yeah, and that's terrific. And, symbols like music and mathematics are a universal language, and they transcend language, they transcend culture, and if nothing else, I think it's part of a well-rounded education would be to understand the importance of symbols in our history, in our lives, and in our science and our religion, all of that.
Have you heard about groups that are now like reading every word of Dante's Inferno and trying to get the code?
Actually, and nothing makes me happier. I wrote Inferno with the there is no prerequisite to have read Dante before you read Inferno. I figured most of the people who come to this sort of mainstream thriller will not have read an epic poem from the 1300s. And yet, part of my hope with writing the novel was that people would say, "Wow, the Divine Comedy sounds like a pretty interesting piece of literature. Maybe I'll go give that a look." And it sounds like a lot of people have.
Oh, all right. Well, any final thoughts for readers?
Well, I hope that people enjoy the book. It's kind of a book with I've heard that it's got a little bit of something for everybody. There's so much art, there's so much action, and there's also a lot of science. And on top of it all, there is a very profound ethical question about where we are headed as a human race, where the planet's headed. This isn't an activist book, and yet it does raise some pretty important questions. And I hope that readers engage on them and debate them.
Well, Dan, I can't thank you enough for joining us today. Thank you so much.
The pleasure's been mine.
All righty. Bye.